from Joshua chapter 4 and from the 10th verse. We've been working our way through the book of Joshua, and before I went off on holiday, we left the high priests holding the ark in the middle of the River Jordan. Well, I think it's probably time to get them out of there, and we're going to do that this evening. Joshua chapter 4 and reading from verse 10. It's a long reading, and so I propose to divide it into two this evening. The first part will take us to the end of chapter 4. Chapter 4, verse 10. Now the priests who carried the ark remained standing in the middle of the Jordan until everything the Lord had commanded Joshua was done by the people, just as Moses had directed Joshua. The people hurried over, and as soon as all of them had crossed, the ark of the Lord and the priests came to the other side while the people watched. The men of Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh crossed over, armed in front of the Israelites, as Moses had directed them. Now you may remember that these 2.5 tribes had opted to stay on the east bank of the River Jordan. And Moses had said, well, if you stay here, if this is going to be your inheritance, then when it comes to entering the land of promise, you need to send armed men across to help your brethren as they fight for their inheritance. And this is a reference to that. About 40,000 armed for battle crossed over before the Lord to the plains of Jericho for war. That day the Lord exalted Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and they revered him all the days of his life, just as they had revered Moses. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "Command the priests carrying the Ark of the Testimony to come up out of the Jordan." So Joshua commanded the priests, "Come up out of the Jordan." And the priests came up out of the river, carrying the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. No sooner had they set their feet on the dry ground than the waters of the Jordan returned to their place and ran in flood as before. On the 10th day of the first month, the people went up from the Jordan and camped at Gilgal on the eastern border of Jericho. And Joshua set up at Gilgal the 12 stones they had taken out of the Jordan. He said to the Israelites, "In the future, when your descendants ask their fathers, 'What do these stones mean?' tell them, 'Israel crossed the Jordan on dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the Jordan before you until you had crossed over. The Lord your God did to the Jordan just what he had done to the Red Sea when he dried it up before us until we had crossed over. He did this so that all the peoples of the earth might know that the hand of the Lord is powerful, and so that you might always fear the Lord your God." Let us worship God. We'll continue the second part of our Bible reading, which continues into chapter 5, Joshua chapter 5, and we read from verse 1. Now, when all the Amorite kings west of the Jordan and all the Canaanite kings along the coast heard how the Lord had dried up the Jordan before the Israelites until we had crossed over, their hearts sank, and they no longer had the courage to face the Israelites. At that time the Lord said to Joshua, make flint knives and circumcise the Israelites again. So Joshua made flint knives and circumcised the Israelites at Gibeah Ha'araloth. Now this is why he did so. All those who came out of Egypt, all the men of military age, died in the desert on the way after leaving Egypt. All the people that came out had been circumcised, but all the people born in the desert during the journey from Egypt had not. The Israelites had moved about in the desert 40 years until all the men who were of military age when they left Egypt had died, since they had not obeyed the Lord. You will remember they refused at the first time of asking to enter the land of promise. For the Lord had sworn to them that they would not see the land that he had solemnly promised their fathers to give us, a land flowing with milk and honey. So he raised up their sons in their place, and these were the ones Joshua circumcised. They were still uncircumcised because they had not been circumcised on the way. And after the whole nation had been circumcised, they remained where they were in camp until they were healed. Then the Lord said to Joshua, today I have rolled away the reproach of Egypt from you. So the place has been called Gilgal to this day. On the evening of the 14th day of the month, while camped at Gilgal on the plains of Jericho, the Israelites celebrated the Passover. The day after the Passover, that very day, they ate some of the produce of the land, unleavened bread and roasted grain. The manna stopped. The day after they ate this food from the land, there was no longer any manna for the Israelites. But that year, they ate of the produce of Canaan. Now, when Joshua was near Jericho, he looked up and saw a man standing in front of him with a drawn sword in his hand. Joshua went up to him and asked, are you for us or for our enemies? Neither, he replied, but as commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come. Then Joshua fell face down to the ground in reverence and asked him, what message does my Lord have for his servant? The commander of the Lord's army replied, take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy. And Joshua did so. Amen, and may God add his blessing to this reading from his holy word. Now you might care to turn to those passages of scripture that we read together earlier. During our holiday in St. Andrews, we visited the Castle Museum, which had in display a historical tableau depicting George Wishart, the first Reformation martyr, burning at the stake. His crime was that he had taught the biblical truths which had found new emphasis at the time of the Reformation. And at that time, I was reminded of the rich heritage which is ours in Scotland. We owe a great deal to men like George Wishart. And on holiday, time and again, we came across little plaques fixed to a whole variety of walls telling us of the accomplishments of men long dead and of the benefits which they have brought us. It's easy, isn't it, to forget how much we owe to the past. We all need tangible reminders to help our memories. And that's how the passage before us opens up this evening. God, you will remember, had delivered his people Israel from the bondage of Egypt. And he had led them to the land of their inheritance. He had both miraculously opened up the Red Sea to let them out of Egypt, and the River Jordan to let them into the promised land. And from beginning to end, it was seen to be God's work. And the memorial cairn which God required Israel to build on the east bank of the Jordan, with stones taken out of the dry riverbed while Israel were crossing, that memorial cairn was intended to be a memory jogger. These stones were to cry out to successive generations, "You are a redeemed people. God promised to bless you, and nothing, not even the River Jordan and Spate, was allowed to stand in the way of the fulfillment of God's purposes." And these stones carried with them a further implication. If a mighty river couldn't prevent you from entering into your inheritance, then if you continue to walk in obedience to God, he will not permit any barrier to stand in the way of the advance of his purpose. When they saw the cairn, they were reminded of the power of God exercised on their behalf. And they were able to say, as we sung earlier, "O God, our help in ages past, our hope for years to come." We need memory joggers. How easily we forget clear evidences of God's power at work on our behalf. Easily forget. Let me give you one example from the New Testament. Do you remember how quickly the disciples forgot Jesus' ability to satisfy the physical needs of men? In Matthew chapter 14, we read of Jesus miraculously feeding 5,000 men. It doesn't tell us how many women and children were there, but 5,000 men. And yet one chapter later, in chapter 15, when Jesus is again surrounded by a great multitude, this time we're told 4,000 men plus women and children, the disciples come, and in verse 33 of that chapter they ask, "Where can we get enough bread in this remote place to feed such a crowd?" You see, they had failed to build a memorial cairn in their memories which would encourage them to trust Jesus to deal with a situation as he had dealt with it in the past. Something to encourage their faith as he sought to handle a similar difficulty. Jesus, of course, realized the weakness of his followers in building such memorial cairns. You remember that before his death, he gathered his disciples around him in the upper room, and as he took the bread and the wine, he gave them a memorial cairn, didn't he? He said, "Do this in remembrance of me." He was saying to them, above all else, "Remember my death and its significance. Build this memorial cairn into your lives. I can remember as a child singing, "Lest I forget Gethsemane, lest I forget thine agony, lest I forget thy love to me, lead me to Calvary." In remembering the cross, our confidence in God's love and grace towards us is strengthened. We, like Israel, are reminded we are a redeemed people. We are reminded too that even the foulness of our sin couldn't be allowed to separate us, and wasn't allowed to separate us from God and his love. When we stand and gaze at the most awful and the most beautiful landmark in human history, our confidence in God's glorious and merciful provision is reinforced. God did that for us. Do you remember the way in which Paul sought to encourage his Roman readership concerning the ability of God to meet every single need that confronted them? He said in chapter 8 of his letter to the Romans, "He who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all, how will he not also, along with him, graciously give us all things?" Do you see how Paul argues from the greater to the lesser? He is saying, here is a memorial cairn. God has given us his son. It's there. We can see that cairn. And if God has done that, is he not going to give us everything else we need? Surely, if he's done that, whatever our needs are, God will minister to them. Now, I want you to notice that the Joshua passage teaches us the importance of sharing with our children all that God has done for us. Time and again, in two places, they are told that this memorial cairn that is built is something that they have to teach their children about. Look at verse 6 in chapter 4. We read it last time. "This cairn is to serve as a sign among you in the future when your children ask you, 'What do these stones mean?' Tell them that the flow of the Jordan was cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. When it crossed the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. These stones are to be a memorial to the people of Israel forever." A memorial cairn for future generations. Let me encourage you this evening not to be reticent to speak to your children and your grandchildren about God. It should be uppermost in our thinking. It should be the most natural thing in the world to speak to our youngsters about God. And when you do that, recount the blessings of God in your life. Yes, and admit your failure and your times of backsliding and your sin, and then point graciously or forwards to God's gracious forgiveness. Point to that and show how God has dealt with you, and God has restored you, and God has blessed you. Encourage your children to ask questions about God's dealings with you. That's how appetites for more of God are awakened in their hearts. We need to bring, you see, our children to the landmarks of our spiritual journey and let them ask the question, what do these stones mean? So that we can say, well, there was the time when God did this, or God did that. That whets the appetites of our children. And that's what Israel are encouraged to do here. And that's what we should be encouraged to do as well. Now notice, the miraculous parting of the Jordan had its promised effect upon the enemies of Israel. Chapter 5, verse 1, now when all the Amorite kings west of the Jordan and all the Canaanite kings along the coast heard how the Lord had dried up the Jordan before the Israelites until we had crossed over, their hearts sank and they no longer had the courage to face the Israelites. Now, it's natural to assume that a wise general would capitalize both upon the fear of his enemies and the enthusiasm of his troops. This is the time, surely, Joshua, to run forward and to take on Jericho. But we find Joshua engaging in religious rituals. And the first of these involved circumcising the whole male population, verse 2 of chapter 5. And we need to remind ourselves of the great importance of circumcision to Israel. Way back in Genesis chapter 17, we find that God entered into a covenant or a special relationship with Abraham and all his descendants. And God committed himself to bless Abraham and his race. And by way of response, Abraham and his descendants had to bear in their bodies a mark of belonging, the mark of circumcision, which was a sign that they were separated to God. They were God's people. It was also a sign of the fact that this God was committed to them in covenant, promise, and blessing. Now, in practice, Israel often failed to live up to the sign. They bore a mark in their bodies which said, "We are a separated people." But that wasn't clear from their lives. They did not live as the people of God. Indeed, in Jeremiah chapter 9 and verse 26, Jeremiah tells Israel, that they are really uncircumcised in their hearts. You're not really separated to God, he's saying. Oh, you bear the mark of circumcision, the outward mark, but you're not living up to that. In your hearts, you've wandered far from God. Now, the situation in Joshua 5 wasn't that the people bore an empty sign of commitment, but they didn't bear a sign of commitment at all. Why? Well, had we time, we would turn to Numbers chapter 14 and verses 32 and 34. Which records God's reaction to Israel's rebellion and refusal to enter their inheritance some 40 years previously. And verse 34 in the Authorized Version reads, "And you shall know my breach of promise, says God." Now, this didn't mean that God was going to forsake Israel. He didn't do that. Rather, it appears that he withdrew his covenant sign, indicating that Israel themselves had alienated themselves from God. They had refused to enter into the spiritual inheritance, which was rightly theirs. But now, that situation had changed. Israel were now prepared to obey God and to enter Canaan. And so at the first opportunity, God restores to them the mark of his ownership, blessing, and destiny. this sign would be there for Israel in all the battles and struggles that lay ahead. A reminder that they had put their wilderness rebellion behind them, but they were now a wholly committed people, God's people. And Israel had, at this time, a renewed sense of being heirs to the blessing of God. Now, I believe that many Christians are able in some measure to identify with the experience that Israel had been through. Like the prodigal Israel, they've strayed far from God. They no longer live as his baptized children. Their behavior belies their Christian profession. And then one day they return in repentance and faith to start anew with God. They show signs of the genuineness of that return by shedding and discarding all that marked their former way of life. The kind of spiritual housekeeping that Paul describes in Colossians chapter 3, verses 1 to 5, where he speaks about putting off all that belongs to the old way of life. There is a new determination to do that, a new consecration. But you see, often despite this new depth of consecration, they never dream that things could be as good as they were before, or that the same blessings could possibly be theirs. They, like the prodigal in Jesus' parable, return quite content for some menial role, and to their delight and their amazement, they discover a God with outstretched arms, a God of infinite grace, a God of tender forgiveness, whose determination to bless them has not wavered one iota. And they enter into a fresh assurance that they really do belong, that they are still co-heirs with Christ and all his blessing. There's a very real link, you know, between obedience and assurance and fruitful service. And we mustn't ever underestimate the value of this sense of assurance, this sense of belonging. Without it, there is often uncertainty and dispiritedness, neither of which emboldens the people of God for conflict. Bishop Latimer, the English reformer, spoke these words. He said, "When I've a settled and steadfast assurance about the state of my soul, I am as bold as a lion. I can laugh at trouble. No affliction can daunt me. But when I am eclipsed in my comforts," in other words, when I have no sense of assurance, "when I am eclipsed in my comforts, I am of so fearful a spirit that I run into a very mouse hole." Now, do you see what Latimer is saying? The place of assurance, the value of assurance, the relationship between that and fruitful service. Well, at the very entry point into the promised land, God comes to Israel and he restores to them the mark of circumcision that they might recognize with a fresh awareness they are the blessed people of God. And in the same way, when the backslidden Christian comes to God and experiences his forgiveness and his restoration, associated with that is God's gracious assurance that they are still co-heirs with Christ, that they have still a destiny, that they have still a significant part to play in the plan and the purpose of God. And that's glorious. One final thing needs to be said about Israel's circumcision. Verse 9, you'll notice, speaks of God rolling away the reproach of Egypt. Now, the Egyptians would have had little knowledge of Israel's backsliding, nor its significance. But they would have heard that these Israelites were dropping like flies in the desert. And how God's people would have been ridiculed. Special people, are you? Really? Heirs of blessing, are you? Caught up in the purposes and eternal decrees of God, are you? What a laugh. Can you imagine the ridicule? Yes, and the soreness to Israel of all of that. And I believe there is something of tremendous psychological importance for us here. You see, at a new point in consecration, there is the danger of being bogged down by memories of the past and being saddled with the baggage of past failures, of living with the ridicule of our failures. And isn't it the technique of the devil to come to the man or the woman who is determined to make a new start, a fresh beginning with God, and bombard their minds with vivid pictures of past failure? Well, God comes to his people at such a time, not only to clothe them with a new sense of belonging, but to roll away the reproach of former failure. And, says God, don't run after it. He rolls it away and says, that's past history. We'll forget about that. God is saying here to Israel, we'll forget about past history. This is a new beginning. Don't be in any way bound by the past. But you'll notice Israel are still not ready for battle. In verse 10, they're called together to celebrate the Passover. Now, it had last been celebrated at the foot of Mount Sinai, 40 years previously. Not since then. The law had forbade the uncircumcised to take part, Exodus chapter 12 and verse 48. Disobedience had cut Israel off from fellowship with God. No Passover meal. But now they have been restored to fellowship with God, and they're eager to express their new obedience in this act of worship. There's a newfound determination with this people not to deviate from the course of action that God expected of them, even though that obedience may have seemed strange to those outside. I'm sure that those looking on must have wondered, why are Israel dithering? Why aren't they attacking Jericho? First of all, they've circumcised all these men, and now they're having a holy huddle over here in the corner. They're having the Passover. What about the military campaign? Joshua had recognized the danger of laying aside spiritual worship because of the pressure of spiritual service. You see, some may well have argued, listen, Joshua, there is a city waiting to be captured. And even suggested, worship can surely be laid aside just now while we're doing God's work. How subtle that temptation is, which causes us to act as though our work for God is more important than God himself. Kenneth McRae a minister in the earlier part of this century, was able to identify this danger in his own heart, and he writes in his diary, "Kept so busy that I had no time for the nourishment of my own soul. It's like a man starving in the cookhouse." Very real. And in my experience, that's not an uncommon condition. Christians so caught up with legitimate Christian service, but God is squeezed out of the lives. Israel, by putting spiritual worship before service, were learning another vitally important spiritual principle. Time spent in fellowship with God is the way in which we become equipped for service. You see, as Israel's faith was focused upon God in the Passover, they remembered his past deliverance from Egypt, his power exercised on their behalf. So that as they marched eventually out to battle, it was with minds which had been refreshed by this knowledge, minds that were now captivated by God. The focus of their attention was not upon the walls of Jericho, but upon the glorious power of God exercised on behalf of his people. The God who divided the waters of the Red Sea and the Jordan would be the God who would cause the walls of Jericho to collapse. And it's seeing this that prepares us for what is to follow. Israel don't complain when they're asked to march around Jericho. Their eyes are fixed upon God and his power. They believe that God is at work. God is at work. God is at work. They advanced with a fresh and quickened faith. Now in Bergedi and Swinton, and further afield, there are walls of resistance built by God's enemy in men's minds and hearts. And it's our task, isn't it, to see those walls collapse. How will that happen? Only as we approach Christian outreach through the door of worship. For it is in the context of fellowship with God that our faith is fixed upon him who causes the stoutest walls to crumble. And we find this principle is reinforced in the amazing incident we read in verses 13 to 15. Joshua moved out of the camp, perhaps on a reconnaissance mission of his own, or perhaps to pray over his strategy for taking Jericho. And he's confronted with a stranger who appears with sword drawn. And the stranger identifies himself as the commander of the Lord's army, none other than the pre-incarnate Jesus. And the timing of this encounter is, I believe, significant. When Joshua was on the path of duty, God met him. This is surely something of what George MacDonald had in mind when he wrote, "Obedience is the opener of the eyes." It's only when we show our determination to be obedient to God, despite pressures to the contrary, that we are likely to meet with the Lord of hosts in this reassuring way. I'm not speaking about visions or seeing with our physical eyes, but having the eyes of our spiritual understanding open and knowing that conviction which God himself gives, that he has drawn near to encourage our hearts. He's not on our side, we are in his. He has drawn near to encourage our hearts. the hearts of those who are determined to be obedient. Joshua finally discovered that he was involved in something bigger than he first realized. And isn't that the same for so many of us engaged in Christian work? You see, Joshua's concern in verse 13 was to ask, are you in my side or the side of my enemies? To which the Lord replied, it's not so much that I am in your side, but you're in mine. And there's a world of difference between the two attitudes. The Lord, and not Joshua, was commander of the Israelite army. But more than that, Joshua's army was just a very small fraction of the army that God had at his disposal to take the promised land. Was Joshua unaware of the unseen heavenly army which constantly attends the work of God? This is beautifully illustrated later on in the Old Testament during the time of Elisha's ministry. And Elisha finds himself in the small village of Dothan with his servant. And they are surrounded overnight by the Syrian army. And the Syrians are determined to wipe Elisha out. They're determined to take his life. And as Elisha and his servant mount the ramparts of the town and see the hosts of Syria around, the servant begins to shake in his welly boots, and Elisha opens his mouth in prayer and says, Lord, open the young man's eye. Let him see the true odds in this battle. And the young man's eyes were open to see the hosts of God who had surrounded the Syrian army, poised to intervene. I think that's a picture that we need to constantly remind ourselves of when we feel discouraged, when we feel outnumbered. They that are for us are more than they who are against us. It's this picture that we need to encourage us in the work in Bergedi and further afield. We need our eyes opened to that. We are involved in a work of eternal dimension. God is constantly calling us to remember his commitment to us and his power engaged on our behalf. And he takes time to prepare his people for battle. He does so to enable them to be disentangled from the past with its power to paralyze, that we might see that our reproach and our failure has been rolled away. It takes time to grasp that spiritual service must be rooted in worship. And we need time to see that we are caught up in something greater and bigger than we could ever begin to imagine. But God is determined to open our eyes that we might see that, that our confidence might be in him. As we move out into the battles that confront us as a fellowship, with that kind of confidence, the God who has exercised his power on our behalf in the past is poised, eager, ready, willing to exercise that self-same power in our midst today. And that, I believe, is quite, quite wonderful.